Studio 360.
How well do we remember really familiar cultural artifacts that we've seen or heard a million times, such as... Now, it seems like that line is supposed to end with, of the world. And if you thought so, you're not alone, but you are wrong. Because of the world only appears in the bridge, not there at the end of the whole song. There is a newish name for this kind of memory glitch. It's called the Mandela effect. That's when multiple people misremember the same thing in the same way. The phenomenon gets its name from Nelson Mandela, who apparently lots of people believed died in prison in the 1980s. There are other examples, like people who think Humphrey Bogart said the line, "Play it again, Sam," in Casablanca. So why are so many of us so certain of so many things that never happened at all? Steve Ramirez is a neuroscientist at Harvard, and he studies how memories, real memories and false memories, are formed in our brains. Steve, thanks for coming in.
It's my pleasure to be here.
So, first off, you're a neuroscientist. How does the brain record a memory?
If I could give you a straightforward answer to that, I'd probably be out of a job. So, luckily, we don't exactly know how the brain stores memories, but I would think about it more as, you know, memories have... there are sights and sounds and smells, and you remember. So, for example, like my favorite memory is when Malcolm Butler intercepted Russell Wilson's pass to win the Patriots Super Bowl 49.
Yeah. And that memory. I guess you grew up in Boston, that means.
Oh, yeah. So when you started this with We Are the Champions, I'm like, this is basically might as well be the song for all Boston sports.
Right. But
So, yeah, I mean, so when you think about it, like the memory of that interception. There's the memory of what happened. There was the interception. There's the emotional feeling that I had, which was basically jumping up and down, cheering and crying out of joy. And there's, again, sights and sounds and smells associated with that memory. So those sights and sounds and smells are mediated through different parts of the brain, which basically communicate with each other in real time to bring to life that rich representation or that rich memory of what happened in the past. So the hippocampus seems to be this crucial component in the brain involved in that process.
Although it couldn't do it by itself, it needs to say, oh, well, what were you smelling then? Or what was playing then? Or what it needs to go elsewhere to kind of retrieve and collect other relevant bits of the memory?
Yeah. So imagine that a memory, for example, that has that's highly visual or highly smelly, for example, then the hippocampus is involved in recruiting parts of visual cortex or parts of smell cortex, for example, and so on. So it basically can help integrate all of these different sensory modalities, we call them, and try to integrate them into some cohesive whole.
Right. Our memories are malleable because of the nature of the design of the brains. Is that why memories are so kind of fungible and revisable?
Yeah. So it's a really hot button right now that, you know, one interpretation is that memories are malleable because the same machinery, for example, the hippocampus, that enables us to recall the past is also the same machinery that enables us to reconstruct the past. And it also happens to be largely the same machinery that helps us imagine ourselves in the future.
Now you've explained to me why that's a good design, that those two things are connected, the remembering the past and imagining the future, because if they were not, then you'd be pretty piss poor at imagining the future, I guess.
Yeah, exactly. And I also think that, you know, it's just like I hesitate, of course, to use the word design, but for me it's more of the machinery isn't perfect, and there's a lot of cognitive hiccups that exist. And sometimes there's real pathologies that exist as a result of these kinds of misfirings. But when you recall a memory, for example, it's not a tape recorder or it's not sort of an iPhone video of the past. Like, it's actually a reconstructive process in that the memories that are most real are probably the ones that we don't recall.
Right.
Because the second that we recall them, we immediately begin this process of modifying those memories with bits and pieces of new information.
Meaning they're virginal and pristine until we mess them up by grabbing them.
Exactly, exactly. Yeah. Which ironically also means that every memory is a kind of almost mild false memory.
Yeah, sounds complicated. Sounds more complicated than it needs to be.
I mean, the way that I put it is we have maybe what, like 80, 90 years in our career to try to reverse engineer what 4 billion years of evolution got a chance to do. So.
Yeah. Well, you're more hopeful than I if you think you have 90, but you're young. a couple of years ago, you and a collaborator figured out how to implant false memories, at least in mice. Walk us through that experiment.
So we managed to find the cells in the hippocampus that were involved in processing the memory of a safe environment. And in this case, we're working in rodents because we have exquisite access to their sort of cognitive machinery. So we were able to find the cells in this case that processed the memory of a safe box that it was put in. And then what we did was we were able to artificially turn that memory on while the animal received just some mild aversive stimuli. It doesn't hurt the animal by any means. It's almost like a static shock. It's just a surprise. When we placed it back in the originally safe environment, the animal actually showed some kind of fear responses to that environment now.
Uh-huh. So you've planted these false memories in mice in a lab, but people do have false memories, remember things that never happened. Are there patterns to those? Are there certain kinds of false memories that tend to develop, and then we can make conclusions about, oh, this is the kind of thing that is subject to this?
You know, if I were to ask you, for example, what's the most famous line from Star Wars? Like, what does Darth Vader say to Luke Skywalker?
Luke, I'm your father?
Yeah, right, exactly. So Darth Vader actually never said, Luke, I am your father. He just said,
no, I am your father.
There's plenty of these instances where, you know, one of the more tragic, albeit famous ones are that, you know, if you ask many people who were old enough to remember 9/11, if you ask them, like, how many times did you see the footage of the first plane, like, hitting the Twin Towers,
right,
you know, they'll say, well, we saw it all day. Like,
right,
of course, you were glued to the TV.
They saw nothing. Yeah.
Right, because that footage wasn't available until 9/12.
Right. The Mandela thing in particular is interesting to me because it was a big deal when Nelson Mandela got out of prison, apartheid ended, he became president immediately in the 90s, years after he was supposed to have died. So I mean, to me, it just seems, maybe it's a false memory, maybe it's just stupidity. I don't know.
I think that, you know, I don't know what our bandwidth for memory is, but I think that there's, for some reason, like, our brain fills in these gaps in these stories. And maybe it's an attention spanny thing where when we're learning about Mandela, we remember, like, oh, wow, he was in jail for that long. And then the rest, you just kind of skim over the Wikipedia page and it doesn't stick.
Yeah. another one of these that people talk about at the other end of world historical importance are the Berenstain Bears. People swear that these books they read as kids or read to their kids were the Berenstain Bears. So from your neuroscientific point of view, how does that come about?
Yeah, it might be some weird confirmation bias that for some reason our brains are susceptible to. Like, we've just seen Stein, or that example, we've just seen that linguistically more and more and more.
Right.
And for some reason that sticks because we're kind of working with, you know, we call it like a schema. Like, we're working with this kind of this backdrop of memories that we've personally experienced. And then those that happen to sort of be confirmed by our previous experience is what we're most likely to believe, even if they're false.
No, it's a shortcut that the brain does. And I
exactly
my name Anderson is spelled S-E-N, and of course every day it's misspelled S-O-N. So I experience that firsthand constantly. Now the Queen song that doesn't end with "Of the World." What do you make of that?
Yeah, it's got to be. So that example actually really struck me because I was singing it along as the intro to this show was happening. And then when you said that it didn't end with "Of the World," I was like, what? Like, yes, it does. And I guess no, it doesn't. But maybe the ending to that song, maybe, you know, a group of people or large masses now obviously sing it that way. So we just interpret it as, well, that's just the way the song is. Like, our memory is already imperfect as it is. And then sometimes when you have multiple people with imperfect memories confirm each other's bias about that particular memory, then it's more likely to kind of snowball. And then you get a little pocket of people that believe A happened when in fact B happened. And then this is a kind of thing that involves now access to technology, access to media, access to each other's opinions that confirm our own and each other's version of our histories that also confirm our own. And then in some instances, like a meme, it reaches escape velocity and then takes on a life of its own.
Well said. And I assume, however, that you don't buy the sci-fi explanations that many people earnestly believe about these kinds of false memories that, oh, it proves we're sliding between these, you know, parallel universes in a multiverse, or, oh, it is the Matrix. It's a glitch in the Matrix.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, this is something that I think it's a really cool idea, but until it becomes a kind of tractable, testable hypothesis, it's very good science fiction, but the key word there being fiction.
Right, right. Steve, it has been a pleasure talking to you, and I really thank you.
The pleasure is all mine. Thank you so much.
You can watch Steve Ramirez's TED Talk about implanting false memories in mice at studio360.org.